we have our first speaker of the night, and that is going to be our longest absence, Ida S., and she is from San Pedro, California. Ida, take it away.
Thank you. My name is Ida. I'm a compulsive overeater. I haven't been talking in a while, so my voice will improve with use. I generally don't like being the oldest person in the room, and I genuinely mean that. But that's the fact, and so I get to accept that. Okay, here's my before story. Is that enough? That has to be enough. That's me within about a week of when I came into Overeaters Anonymous in April of 1975 at 225 pounds. So I am I'm a 100-pounder. I've been abstaining since my phone call to OA, which happened 4 days before my first meeting. And I've been fasting for normal for 46 years. So that's about all you're going to hear about my story, because, you know, I've been telling this story for a long time, and I'm really sick of it, and it's not really very interesting, and it's nothing you haven't heard before. I did come from an alcoholic family. My father was an alcoholic. My mother was a compulsive overeater. So what's new? It seems that many of us came from that situation. My top weight was 240. I was a 19-year-old when I hit that. And I spent most of my adulthood in my 20s floating around between, a low of 150 and a high of 225. So, but I really want to get on to what I wanted to talk about tonight. I'm 76 years old, and I can no longer talk off the cuff, and that is just the fact. I get either I lose track of what I'm doing, or I get hijacked by the story, and as many of you know, and I do know a lot of people on this meeting, thanks to Region 2, I know a lot of people, and thanks to Zoom, where I've met a lot of people at meetings where I would not normally be at. But I get hijacked by my stories. So I went looking for inspiration. It's what I wanted to talk about tonight. And I was having trouble because it wasn't coming. And I was talking to a couple friends of mine in program on Sunday. And I said, well, you know, I've got this book here. And it's a notebook. And I had written down things that I'd heard over the years, in program and out of program, that mean a lot to me. And one of them said, well, there's yours, you'll just read it and talk about the quotes that you have in the book. And then I was looking at the quotes, and I realized that they fell into two major categories. One, food and abstinence, and the other, perfectionism. And I think it was the next day, I was doing my meditation, and it came to me. Food plus perfectionism equals death. And I thought, you know what? That's it. That's my thought. That's what I want to talk about. And so I want to talk about one of the saddest things I have observed in Overeaters Anonymous is people trying to be perfect with their food and killing themselves for it because it wasn't possible. I have seen too many people fall apart over small shifts. And it makes me very, very sad because I learned early on in program that I had to learn to bend without breaking. And someone pointed out the analogy of a tree. You know, a tree that is rigid and stiff can't stand the wind. But a tree that can bend and hold on to its roots will stand for another day. And what I've been able to do, and the reason I'm an abstainer for 46 years, is that I have learned to bend without letting go of my roots so that I can remain standing. So my first year of abstinence was stunning because I went from eating out of the garbage to abstinence overnight. And I went on a very, very strict losing weight abstinence. And I didn't do it with a sponsor because I didn't get a sponsor until 5 months into the program. But I knew from the get-go that what I put in my mouth had something to do with what my body looked like. So I really went on a very strict losing abstinence. And it was crap food, highly processed, packaged lunch meats, frozen pizza. Yes, frozen. Well, I cooked it, but it came to me frozen. And what I would just, you know, I wouldn't touch, you know, now. But I had to stay out of the kitchen, and I had to keep my hands off food. And so I bought as much prepackaged, pre-weighed and measured food as I could get. And that was processed. And I went to extremes. And for that, I was rewarded with an 80-pound weight loss in my first 8 months of the program. The weight just dropped off. But I also made myself sick. And if anybody that I was sponsoring was eating like I was my first year, I would have a serious conversation with them. Serious, serious. But it was a measure of my desperation because I came into this program absolutely unable to live in the body that I had at the time. I'd had it. So over the years, I've learned to ask myself certain questions about my food. Is it, if I'm planning to eat something, okay. I have to ask myself, does that food make me hungry? There, I've learned through experience, there are foods that make me hungry. Am I willing to pay that price to be hungry for that food? And then I ask myself, is it easier to eat it or to not eat it? Because there's a price that's going to be paid. And what price will I have to pay for eating that food? And I'm not just talking about weight gain. I'm talking about the obsession of the mind. I just don't want to be so obsessed with a particular food. And I ask myself, is it easier to eat it or not? And then there are things that I have to remember. I am powerless over food, but I am not helpless. I am not helpless. I have the steps, the traditions, the tools, and the fellowship of the program. I am no longer helpless. I have learned that food is not a benevolent higher power. For many years, food was my higher power because that's what I turned to when I was in trouble. But it is not a benevolent higher power, and I have to have a benevolent higher power. Now, as many of you know, I'm an atheist, but I have a benevolent higher power, and that is the power of the 12 steps and the process of the 12 steps and the program of Overeaters Anonymous. And that process only works for my good. Binge eating never works for my good. Never. I ask myself, am I willing to eat this food in front of you? And if I'm not willing to eat it in front of you, that's telling me I probably shouldn't be eating it, period. Okay. And I learned that I can eat anything I want. I just can't eat it all at the same time. And I am very fortunate in that I do eat what I want. But, you know, it was a process of learning to love, you know, the one you're with rather than the one you want. And I have a food plan that makes me happy. It has changed remarkably over time. And there was no need for me to change my abstinence state because I changed my food plan. Most of my food changes have been for medical reasons. I have a very rare autoimmune disease that shows up in my skin, and it has many triggers, and many of them are foods. I can't eat citrus. If I eat citrus, I will develop a rash, and I will itch uncontrollably, probably a 9 on a pain scale. So I don't eat citrus. I haven't had an orange in God knows how long. I have a jaw disorder, which means I can't chew certain foods. I haven't had a carrot stick in decades, you know, because it will give me a headache. I recently became a vegetarian. I did that piece by piece. I first, you know, quit eating mammals and then went on and on. And now I've just declared myself a vegetarian, which has greatly changed my food plan. When my husband was sick, and many of you knew my husband, John, when he was sick, I became pre-diabetic from stress. And for a while I had to eat like a diabetic. And thanks to my discipline and thanks to what I've learned in Obedience Moms, I was able to make these changes in my food immediately, overnight, just like I started to abstain. Overnight, I started eating like a diabetic. Overnight, it took me longer to eat or to quit eating oranges. Let's get really truthful. You know, I had to experiment with that, but citrus. You know, I know what I will pay for if I eat it. And one of the big things I've learned is that I don't have to be perfect. I just can't pretend that I am. And I also don't have to be perfect to be wonderful. And that applies not only to my food, but to my life. Now, I have never claimed to be totally free of the obsession. Never have. And it says in our 12 and 12, do we ever achieve a permanent freedom from food obsession? Yes and no. Long-timers do have this miraculous freedom most days, but occasionally, for some, the obsession returns. How do we get through these times without returning to compulsive eating? We don't panic. Instead, we quietly reaffirm our personal guidelines and ask our higher power, to help us continue within them. Then we turn away from food and eating to focus our attention on our OA fellowship and the 12 steps. As we work the steps using the tools of the program, a plan of eating, sponsorship meetings, telephone writing, literature, action plan, anonymity, and service, we find the help we need. OA friends lovingly remind us that this too shall pass. It does pass, and our obsession is lifted again. This abstinent way of life continues on a daily basis so long as we continue to trust a higher power. With our lives, renew our step 3 commitment daily and practice all of the 12 steps. So, you know, the literature tells me that my obsession will come and go. But if I But I was taught by the lady who 12-stepped me in this program that I would forget why I was abstaining. She said, you will forget. But if you keep abstaining, you will remember. And then on page 67, it says, now that we have completed the first 9 steps, we can face the future with a new confidence. We no longer need the crutch of excess food because we have discovered a way of life that nourishes us physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Our challenge from here out will be to continue following the path daily as we are guided by the last 3 steps of our 12-step program. So I do have confidence. I tell people, and I do have confidence that I will not binge. And it's truly not arrogance, it's belief in the program. And I told my sponsor this a few years ago, and I said, you know, I'm not afraid I'm going to binge again. And she said, well, of course you're not afraid, you have the promises. And that's the truth, I own the promises. And as long as I own the promises, I don't have to be afraid of the food. But like I said, you know, I don't have to be perfect. Now, for many years, I never used the word perfectionist applied to me. In spite of the fact there was tremendous evidence to the contrary, I would say that I wasn't a perfectionist. Now, I was a school teacher. I had a school-wide course. Believe it or not, get this. I took 3 children, did not screen for voices, 3 children from each classroom, K through 5, and twice a week I brought them into the auditorium and I taught them singing. And I've got a terrible voice, but I would teach them singing. And school would start in September and we would put a holiday program on in December. And I would start rehearsing for the December program in September, folks, because God forbid those kids make a mistake while I'm directing them. And by October, the kids knew every word of every song, every line of dialogue, and we still had 2 months to go before the program. But I was absolutely determined that it was going to be perfect. But I never called myself perfectionist. I drove kids crazy because of it. I would invite people to dinner at my house, and I would spend weeks designing the perfect menu and coordinating, you know, the tablecloth with my dress. And I swear to God, but I was not a perfectionist. Okay. And I would put out these beautiful tables. And food, and just, it was just, you don't want to turn down a meal at my house, so I just want you to know that right up front. But again, I never thought I was a perfectionist. And I finally realized that I was one day when I was meditating about almost 7 years ago. I started doing secular mindfulness meditation. And I was meditating, and I was doing a loving-kindness meditation, and it was time for me to do it on a person that I was having difficulty with. And I found this person, and the meditation leader said, now, this will be difficult, but try to think of something good about that person. And I had no trouble making a list of all the wonderful things about this person. But I was ready to toss her because of one thing. I was furious at her for one thing. And I realized that I wanted my friends to be perfect. Perfect. And one bad thing was enough to throw them away. And then I started thinking, Ida, what about you? And I suddenly realized that I expected perfection from myself, and that when I didn't get it, I was ready to toss myself. And all the good about me was worthless if I wasn't totally perfect. And it was such a shock to my system. And my perfectionism came to a head and put me through a really bad time after my husband died in 2016. Because my perfectionism rose out of the fear that I am not good enough. And after my husband died, I was convinced that I had not been a good enough wife, in spite of all evidence to the contrary. And I went into one of the worst emotional states that I ever experienced in my life. And my husband died of cancer, but he had dementia. And I took care of him for 4 years, and I rarely left him. I was with him 24/7, almost, I would say, 99 9/10% of the time. But I started beating myself up because I wasn't there 100% of the time. I expected myself to be superhuman. And I hear people in this program expecting themselves to be superhuman. It just doesn't work. It just leads to a death of the soul. It really does. So, what did I do about it? I started practicing mindful self-compassion in 2017, and I started to apply it to myself and to my situation with John. And I wrote inventory. But instead of writing a four-column inventory, to which I am very committed, I wrote what I felt I had done wrong and the truth about it. For example, I felt like I was deserting John when I put on my headset and watched Downton Abbey on my laptop, because I wasn't talking to him. And the truth was that I bought a laptop so I could sit next to him. That's just a small example, but it went on and on. And I had to learn to start to forgive myself for not being a 100% perfect wife, 100% perfect person. During those 4 years, there were a few times when I had total meltdowns. And when they were happening, I was thinking, my husband will forget this, but I won't. And he would within minutes. But the OA 12 and 12 says, we need to forgive ourselves for what we regret doing or not doing, and for not being all we could have been. Self-forgiveness means letting go of negative feelings such as shame and guilt. The power to extend forgiveness to others comes from self-forgiveness. To refuse to forgive is to continue to hurt ourselves. Luckily for us, the OA 12 and 12 second edition is full of forgiveness and full of compassion and self-compassion. And that is what I had to practice. And I'm going to run out of time. And I am so sorry, because I never got around to shame. Holy crap, you know. When I was behaving badly as a wife, but in quotes, I felt shame, not guilt, because I was a mistake. And thanks to Overeaters Anonymous, I know that I'm not a mistake. I made mistakes, but I'm getting better on a daily basis. And I'm, after almost 47 years in program and 76 years on the planet, I am really thrilled to tell you I'm still learning. And I'm still really glad to be here. And I would just like to conclude with, we don't have to do it perfectly. There's my thought. We don't have to do it perfectly. And we don't have to do it by ourselves. And with that, I pass. Thank you.